Welcome again, everyone, to our program today. We have a very special program ahead of us, Open Access Success Stories. Get your OA program noticed. And we want to welcome onto the call today attendees from across North America, from across Europe as well, representing society publishers, big pharma, universities and other institutions, global publishers and startups alike. So we know how important this is to all of you to understand the direction that Open Access is headed, what it means to all members of the various communities that are involved, the authors particularly in this show today, but obviously of concern as well to publishers, institutions, libraries, and of course, their readers, their public. So again, welcome to everyone. Research goes on as ever in the lab and in the field, but researchers in today's open access environment have a lot more than only science to think about. For help, OA authors turn to publishers for services that enable discoverability and expand public understanding. The support builds lasting relationships with valued contributors. Copyright Clearance Center is very happy to welcome you to a webinar that is going to get behind the story and learn more about how scholarly publishers and their authors can use new media and creative information tools to create real and lasting impact. Our special guest today, Charlie Rappel, co-founder of Kudos, will share how their award-winning service maximizes the reach and impact of research publications with trackable links that generate higher downloads, citations, and altmetrics. And we trust that you will agree with us that funders and faculty committees expect to see today demonstrable results for research. The public is also looking to understand better how tax money is spent. And authors are always looking for a success story. So with that as our background, we'll tell you how our program will run. We are tweeting the program today, and you're welcome to join us. You can follow Copyright Clearance Center, at Copyright Clear, the hashtag for today's program and for all the programs in our continuing series on open access is CCC Open Access. And over the next 45 minutes or so, we'll be taking a look at how certain tools are now available to authors and to their publishing partners to create impact, boost visibility. We're going to offer some very specific and very immediately useful tips for success. I would expect that a number of you in the audience today have been hearing recently from Copyright Clearance Center. We've been sending out a series of white papers and other background information on the next wave of open access. And I want to just point out that if you've seen this, if you haven't seen it, by the way, you're welcome to write to us at marketing@copyright.com. We'll make sure you get a copy of it. But a special report undertaken by a former guest on this program, Rob Johnson, along with the Research Information Network and the University of Sheffield in the UK, has identified a number of issues that are going to be important in the next 12 months when it comes to open access, and they are relevant to our discussion today. For example, it's important to understand, as I've mentioned briefly, that funders are ratcheting up the pressure. They really are expecting to see increasingly ambitious goals realized for opening up the results of the funding of the research that they have funded. In the European Commission, for example, they have set a goal for 60% of European publicly funded research articles to be available under OA, open access, by the end of 2016. And this, of course, is something that publishers and authors and institutions need to respond to. And it is generating the development of an open scholarly infrastructure. And publishers play a central role in developing and supporting that particular infrastructure. And they're looking to find ways to integrate and embed what is done across the workflow to really help to grow and expand this now broader information landscape. So for more on all of that, do let us know. We'll be happy to send you a copy. So with that, as background two, I want to bring on to our program today Charlie Rappel. Charlie joins us from just outside of Oxford. And Charlie, welcome.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be here.
Well, we're looking forward to talking with you and to learning more about what you see there at Kudos. By way of introduction, Charlie Rappel is Sales and Marketing Director of Kudos, which helps researchers and their publishers and institutions increase the reach and impact of published research. Prior to co-founding Kudos, Charlie was Associate Director of TBI Communications, a strategic marketing consultancy to scholarly publishers and societies. An important point, I think, is that she really does understand both the societies and their publications very well indeed. She writes regularly for the Scholarly Kitchen blog, so many of you may be familiar with her byline there. And we learn that she drives a 1974 Citroën DS, which I have to say, as someone who spent some time in France, those are really remarkable automobiles, a sort of a futuristic notion of an automobile. It's a French automobile designed by an Italian sculptor. I just really love those things. So I'm jealous of you there, Charlie.
I love that you bring that up. Yeah, I'd love to think about the metaphors of what my car says, but probably I think it is that that futuristic design that we'd like to cling on to, and maybe the sensation of floating through air.
Right. I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think that really that notion of looking to the future and also something beautiful, something well-designed, something that is I think really recognizable immediately is a good way to think about what you're trying to do there at Kudos, and we'll get into that. But in this new open access publishing environment, it's a new environment for everybody, but particularly in open access, where impact is really all about discoverability, about visibility, about making sure that the research that's been funded does reach as wide an audience as possible. Kudos has really begun to try to understand better this environment. It's a world of many kinds and many sources of metrics, the way that we understand if, in fact, we are reaching everyone. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I think we've seen a real explosion in metrics, obviously, in the digital era. So we've gone from the traditional metrics that we would have used pre-online, so we would have been interested in citations primarily, in press coverage, media coverage. Going online enabled such expansion in the ways that we can measure the success of what we're doing, and suddenly we were able to start counting views and downloads, clicks. Obviously, a lot of work has been done by Counter and other organizations to help us make sense of all of that, and we feel fairly stable in terms of what the different digital measures mean. And we're now at this exciting time where we have the alt metrics, the emerging layers of attention data, and lots of different organizations attempting to capture that attention data, to analyze it, to boil that down to what does that mean for the topicality of the work, the popularity of the work, the quality of the work. And of course, that's a difficult thing to do. We see lots of experimentation there, and we see organizations like NISO, the National Information Standards Organization, beginning to start to try and develop standards around this. But I think for an individual researcher, this could be pretty overwhelming. It's a complex landscape. There's several different providers. Most researchers will, of course, be familiar with their citation providers. They'll know Web of Science, they'll know Scopus, they'll know Google Scholar citations. Some researchers are now getting more familiar with the newer social metrics, the attention metrics, and they will have signed up for Impact Story or Plum, or they'll know about how to look at altmetrics on altmetric.com. But it's not an easy picture for them yet. We still have a lot of different sources that they need to try and know about where to get that data from. And then there's the challenge of trying to look at that in the round and make sense of what do these numbers mean? How do I put them together with the numbers that I'm used to looking at? You know, I used to take my citation counts and turn that into an eigenfactor or an H-index and make some sense of it that way. What am I supposed to do with these newer metrics? I think that's still the challenge that researchers are facing.
Right, and indeed, it is a confusing environment. There's talk about donuts and plums and a whole buffet of metrics, really. And what I suppose researchers and their publishing partners really have to get to is a perspective, what this means and whether it correlates to anything important. I mean, there are metrics, but how important are they? And that must be the real challenge.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is what the altmetric community is grappling with at the moment, not just the how to do that, but indeed whether that's what we should be trying to do. I was at the 2 a.m. conference, the second altmetric conference in Amsterdam in October this year, which is a really fascinating group of real advocates and pioneers in the field of altmetrics. We actually had all four of the signatories of the altmetric manifesto in a room together for the first time. So there was a lot of inspiring conversation among people who really get this stuff and are working really actively to develop this field. And even in that context, or perhaps especially in that context, there was a lot of discussion and confusion or uncertainty about quite what we should be trying to do with altmetrics. Should we be trying to correlate them to citations? Should we see them as a precursor, an indicator of what might happen with citations? Or should we see them as completely different, as representative of a different form of interest, a different form of impact? And that's an unanswered question still right now. What we need to be able to do is dig into the attention that is represented by those metrics and do some more qualitative analysis around the demographics of people whose attention is represented in altmetric and their intentions. Are they academics? Are they using this work or talking about these works for academic purposes? Or do altmetrics really begin to capture that broader impact?
Right, and I think that's the point, so that when people are looking for evidence of real impact, you have to define impact. And here we're looking at a representation of that very traditional notion of academic impact, of research standing on the shoulders of giants, kind of building on the scientific literature that has come before and inching forward with every article towards newer information, greater discoveries, and so forth. But as you point out, in this new environment, that academic impact continues to be important, but it is now not in competition, but it is adjacent to this other type of impact, this more social, cultural, public impact.
Exactly. And of course, the nature of your broader impact will vary depending on the field that you're in. So you might be trying to create and measure impact on people's health and well-being. If you're working in a clinical field, you'll be trying to look at to what extent your research is informing policy and is ultimately affecting health outcomes for patients. In other fields, you might be wanting to see the impact of your work on economic policy. You might be looking to try and understand the extent to which your work is accessible to the general public. You know, there is so much interest in taxpayer access to research, and of course, the open access movement enables that on one level, but does that additional level of availability actually help to increase the impact of the work? And there's some really interesting efforts to try and understand that too. And of course, that is an important, open access has an important contribution to make in all types of impact, because even on the academic side of things, the concept of open access being broader than just having the ability to read the text, but actually also encompassing reuse and repurposing of the material it contains, of the data behind it, and so on. That's an important end of the spectrum in terms of impact, because, of course, that really does enable other people to stand on your shoulders if they can take your data, take your methods, take every aspect of your work and plug it into what they're doing and be readily and openly licensed to do that. That's a level of academic impact beyond that which can be measured in citations. So there's also some interesting work underway thinking about how we can capture and evaluate that broader kind of academic impact. How can we look at research data impact and so on? So all of the interpretations or the definitions of impact are up for grabs at the moment as we try and think about new ways to plan them in from early in the research cycle, and then right at the other end of the spectrum, new ways of trying to capture and measure them.
Right. Well, we are speaking today with Charlie Rappel, who is the co-founder of Kudos, and looking at an important subject when it comes to open access, which is getting your OA publishing program noticed and the variety of innovative author services that are available to achieve that. And, you know, Charlie, when you were speaking there about the various types of impact, you made a point that I think we want to expand on, and that is that open access, when it comes right down to it, is about availability. It's making the material available. But availability does not immediately translate to visibility. And so that impact that the funders, that the institutions, that the researchers themselves are looking for really doesn't end with availability. It then goes a step further towards this notion of visibility.
Right, and this was one of the areas that we first began to explore a few years ago before we started Kudos, when we were still thinking about it as a project and doing our kind of background exploration. We did a survey of researchers. We had about 4,000 responses from around the world, from across a lot of different subject areas, and interestingly, at lots of different career levels as well. So not just early career researchers, but also researchers quite established in their career, still struggling with creating visibility for themselves and their work. And I think one of the this all correlates with the explosion in social media or communications media more broadly. There are now so many different options open to researchers in terms of how they communicate their work. That it's quite an overwhelming landscape. It's quite difficult for them to know where to put their energies in that respect. And certainly you see researchers experimenting with many different systems and tools and networks, but typically without being able to really pull back together the insight they need to say, this has been worth doing. And so what we found when we started our exploration in this area was a high proportion of researchers feeling uncertain, lacking confidence in terms of what they should be doing to communicate their work. And then in too many cases, therefore, just not doing anything because they've got other pressures on their time, so much else to do. And as with all of us, when you're not really sure how to progress a task, however much you know you should be doing it, it will fall to the bottom of the to-do list if you aren't really sure how to get started. And that was really the instigation, the impetus for us to start developing the Kudos service and the toolkit that we now have, was this sense that actually very little guidance was available, and it wouldn't take much for us to crystallize down some tips, some tools, some support for researchers that could really get people started and could level the playing field for researchers. One of the things that both fascinates and slightly sometimes concerns me is this potential celebritization of research, in that some researchers do have great online profiles. They're very successful at promoting themselves and their work and using the available tools to increase their visibility. And that's fabulous. You know, I wouldn't like to take anything away from them. But, of course, that could run the risk then that the research that gains interest and visibility, and therefore potentially you could start to see a Matthew effect, I guess, around people because they're good at communications rather than necessarily because they have the best work. So what we really wanted to do was create a single, standard, simple toolkit that all researchers could use so that everybody had at least a fighting chance of increasing the visibility of themselves and their work alongside those communication superstars.
Right. And you know, Charlie, there's so many tools that are available, as you point out, to everyone, to researchers, to all of us today. And I'm thinking of Twitter, for example, and to your point, just because one tweets a lot doesn't necessarily mean one has much to say. And in fact, what we're really looking at here is not only just visibility itself, but the visibility to the right kinds of people, to the various publics that are important, but also to the research community.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is something that researchers and in our publishing world, authors effectively, often forget that they are the people at the centre of the most appropriate hub. They are the hub of the most appropriate network of people interested in their work. And I think, again, because of an uncertainty about how to go about increasing the visibility of their work, people will often push responsibility for that back to their institution or their publisher or their funder or their society in some cases, with a sense of, I'm going to let those guys get on with that. You know, they know what they're doing. And of course, to an extent, that's right, that the publisher will have marketing and PR teams who will have the specialist skills of doing outreach. But of course, the author themselves is still the one with the most appropriate knowledge of the work. They may not have the marketing skills, but they've certainly got the subject expertise and the passion that will help to convey their work most effectively. And if they are to just tell a few people in their own networks about it, that can start a ball rolling in precisely the right direction in a way that publisher efforts or institutional efforts will be much less able to do. You know, it's much harder as a publisher to know exactly who's going to be interested in this piece of work, whereas the author will, of course, know that already because they are so steeped in the research community. So enabling that work to find its way out to the right people, to find its audience, to find its readers, is something that authors and publishers are so well placed to collaborate on because between them they have exactly the right blend of experience and skills on the one hand and subject expertise and networks on the other hand.
Right, and I think, Charlie Rappel, you have laid out pretty well what the issues are, what the challenges are, what the real difficulty is in sorting through all the available tools and so forth. And as always with thinking about these kinds of things, it comes down to some pretty simple rules. And as a writer myself, I'm always concerned with communicating well. And like everything else, it's about plain language. It's about being clear and direct. And tell us how you got to that sort of eureka moment when you realized that the scientists, the researchers, and their publishing partners can really achieve the kind of impact that they're looking for by really getting to the essence of what the particular piece of research is about.
Yes, and I actually genuinely did have a eureka moment. I have a long-term friend who I've known for years. He's a professor of atmospheric physics and, in fact, a professor of nephology, which is the study of clouds. And for many years, once I'd started working in the scholarly publishing world, he would send me links every time he had a paper published. And I would, with the best will in the world, go and look at his paper and usually be pretty much boxed even by the abstract, and would write back and congratulate him on another great publication and hope that he never really asked me if I'd understood what he'd written, because inevitably I hadn't. Then one day he pointed me to one of his papers, and with it was a video that I think his institution had created but his publisher had posted. So it was a real team effort. And the video was just a couple of minutes, if that. It was him out in the field with some of his instruments, and he was explaining in the simplest of plain language what he had done in this particular study and what they had found. And just with the aid of, you know, a whiteboard and a pen and a couple of simple charts that he drew right then and there, he was able to suddenly make the clouds part for me. It's the pun is not entirely intended. And suddenly I understood this paper that he was referring to. And then looking back at the paper itself and its abstract, it was almost like I had now had a Rosetta Stone to help me work my way through it. And the language that he used in his video, where he just talked about day-to-day changes in pulses of electricity in the atmosphere, now helped me to sort of understand the language he used in the paper, where he talked about diurnal temporal this, variation that, words that I hadn't, you know, entirely understood and certainly not altogether, were now so much clearer. And that was my eureka moment where I thought, if you had this for every paper, if you just had a quick summary from the author as if they were talking to a family friend, and just saying in simple language, this is what this piece of work is about, this is why it's important, this is essentially what we've uncovered. Wow, what an enormous value that could be for so many people. I think not just for people outside their field, although enormously advantageous there, but also when you're trying to, as a reader, wade through so much research, in so much new literature every year, being able to just browse a quick snippety, this is what it's about and why it's important, at a high level, would help you to do that kind of first level of triage of the whole literature, and hopefully might help you therefore to skim and scan across a much broader range of what you might read, and make more informed decisions about what you then go on to read in more depth. And of course there are also automated advantages to this. You know, search engines can use these simple language explanations to help a broader range of people find this work, because it effectively broadens the taxonomy of search terms that will then lead to that work. So I got really excited with this one example from my friend, and that was really what helped shape what Qdos then has gone on to become.
Right. Well, you know, and I think about it this way, Charlie. It's thinking about some of the really outstanding and successful television presenters on science in the UK. I hope I recall the name correctly. David Attenborough, Carl Sagan, and others of that ilk. They are able to do just what you said. They're brilliant scientific minds, but they're able to communicate it in a way that really reaches the audience. And so let's get to some tips that everyone on the line can put into place and put to work for themselves right away. And you began to reference the search engines. They rule so much of our lives these days. And really, it's important to think about that commonly used but not so well understood notion of search engine optimization.
Yeah, I think this is something we've obviously all been interested in for a long time, but perhaps haven't always gone as far as giving our authors specific guidance with a view to search engine optimization. We've often focused on it at the level of what we need to do with our website. But of course, it does also come down to the content in the website. And I think there are so many different hints and tips we can give to authors. For example, around keywords, it's really important to take both a top-down and bottom-up approach as an author choosing your keywords. Both think about what are the potential readers of this work going to be looking for, and then sort of map that against what words have I used frequently in my text, and make sure that you sort of pitch at the right level then in the middle of that, making sure that you're keeping the breadth of your audience in mind. You will want to be, hopefully, well, depending on the nature of the work, you might be trying to appeal to early career researchers. You might be trying to make sure that other Nobelists are reading this. You might be specifically just trying to aim at fellow specialists. You might also be trying to reach people in other fields. And I think it is useful as part of the process of as you write your work to think about those audiences and think about the language that they might use.
And I was going to say, when it comes to our friends in Mountain View there at Google, they get really pretty particular. Their view of the world is less is more. And so that's for just about everything, including the titles of articles and so forth, keeping titles short. In fact, your research has shown that we can get down to the number of characters.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting point, actually, that I think we haven't yet acknowledged in how we title papers. We still often practice the behaviors from the print era, where we're imagining people browsing a table of contents and stopping short when they see a kind of clever or witty title. So many of the papers that I see published these days still have this kind of two-clause approach. And the first clause is something clever and witty, victory on an invisible enemy. And then the second part will be the kind of meaningful piece, success in fighting this disease with that therapy. That's a great example from Witold Kienzsch there. And actually, a search engine is going to lose interest halfway through that, and it's only going to bother to tag the work, to weight the work based on the sort of witty and less meaningful first part. It's my experience, or certainly Google's guidance as well, that you need to get the really important words, your keywords effectively, into the first 60 to 80 characters of the title. And so that's quite a shift from the way that we have been constructing titles for papers. And I'm as guilty of this as anybody. I mean, the very first paper I ever published, the first part of the title was After the Gold Rush, because I was a Neil Young fan, and then the second part kind of got more into the substance. So, I mean, that's just one quick tip there, that you need to keep the title short, and you need to get those keywords and the meaningful substance of the title right up there at the beginning.
And people should also know, Charlie, that the research shows that something as simple as question marks and colons help to push an article sort of down the list, down the...
Very interesting. I mean, I don't think there's been a definitive study on any of this yet, but there are some interesting studies that PLOS One have published and Biomed Central, another one, which show that the more special characters you have and the more narrow you make your title, you know, if you focus it too specifically on one region, you will reduce the number of citations, and I think that is in part because you will be making it less search engine friendly, and therefore, you know, it's not, if it doesn't appear on the first page of Google's results, we all know sadly that it's going to get much less traffic, and that is therefore going to lead to many fewer citations. So there's some really interesting tips that we can give authors here to help them get their work out there and finding its audience.
Right. And Charlie, this effort that you've made, the research you've undertaken, and the work you've done with your partners at Kudos helped to win Kudos the ALPSP Award for Innovation in Publishing just in September at the annual ALPSP conference there in London. And that must have been for you a really – obviously you must have been very proud, but it must have been a confirmation that authors and their publishing partners are really looking for this kind of help. It all sounds pretty easy on the face of it, but getting to that kind of success story really does take some important tools and some guidance.
Yeah, absolutely. The winning of the award was, I mean, I'm still smiling now. It was a very exciting moment for us. I think it is absolutely testament to the fact that many of us are grappling with these same issues across the community. And that was one of the things the judges really picked up on, is that no one group, no one organization can address this challenge. It needs to be done as a partnership between researchers and their institutions and their publishers, and ideally others too, the funders and the societies. And this is a really... this is something that we've really tried to embrace at Kudos and provide this kind of shared service, sitting in the middle, helping researchers communicate their research across all of their different publications, no matter where they've been published, but also with providing a central toolkit from which they can manage whichever channels they use to communicate. So whether they're trying to spread the word via email or social media, we can help them measure the effectiveness against that, against a range of metrics. So we're also trying to bring in metrics, including usage data from publishers, citation data, and altmetric data. So trying to simplify this, but also provide a community space for it to happen in. And, you know, there's still a long way for us to go. You know, obviously we're delighted, and it's not, we've been lucky to win, and indeed another award since then, the New England Publishing Collaboration Award, which again is testament to this idea of the need for shared services and the value of collaboration in this area. And we've got lots to do. We've still got a very ambitious vision for the ways in which we can improve what we've already got, serve more audiences, help more people get their research out there, find the audiences for their work. That's really so much what we're trying to do.
Well, we would like to get to some of the questions from our audience. We're already seeing a couple of those. If you do have a question for Charlie Rappel, please use the chat box in the lower right corner of the screen. Let us know what you're thinking about and what your reactions are to what you've just heard from Charlie Rappel, co-founder of Kudos. If you are tweeting, and we've been talking about using social media, so we hope you are doing that. If you're joining us on the in the online conversation that accompanies our webinars, the hashtag is CCC Open Access. You can follow us at Copyright Clear. And, you know, I want to bring into the program right now my colleague Chuck Hemingway, who's with me here at the CCC office. And Chuck, you get around to a number of conferences, I think some of the same conferences Charlie attends. And I suppose you are hearing from OA publishers of all kinds, the startups and the legacy publishers alike, about the rising importance of authors to their programs. What are you hearing from these publishers about the kinds of services like Kudos as far as sort of helping them make the OA program successful?
In general, I'm hearing a lot. There's a lot more planning. There's a lot more attention being paid to these types of services. Although I will say there's also, it comes with it, this quandary of how to deliver them, how to transact with their authors and then what part of the manuscript workflow. So we've been having quite a few conversations about these sorts of things.
Right, and you know, although we've been emphasizing the attraction of using these kinds of tools for authors for the sake of ensuring that the research they've done has greater impact, that it satisfies the expectations of funders, that in fact it helps them within their own research community, this is important for publishers as well. And at Copyright Clearance Center, we're looking at it across that whole workflow from the author's submission through publication and beyond. And the solution, RightsLink for Open Access, I think sort of is an opportunity for publishers to begin to work with these kinds of tools and really satisfy the author's expectations around customer service and around helping them promote the work and being more successful generally.
Yeah, that's true. And so a lot of the services that the publishers now are talking about making available to their authors are also very much in service of the publisher, and Kudos being a great example. You know, what's good for the author is also great for the publisher. In this case, getting more recognition of that particular article, and you know, driving the share of views to use that content.
All right. Well, if you do have a question for either Charlie Rappel, co-founder of Kudos, or for my colleague here, Chuck Hemingway, please let us know. Use the chat box in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. And, you know, we've been talking, Charlie Rappel, about communities here. And when it comes right down to it, whoever is thinking about publication of research, the authors, the publishers, and the institutions that support them, you know, again, it's really about the end user. And this is a world we live in today where we're all, you know, carrying smartphones and using Google and purchasing things on Amazon and all that. So our end user expectation is just getting higher and higher. It's a real challenge, isn't it, for the authors and for the publishers to really kind of meet the expectations that are set when we go home at night and, have a tablet in our lap?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, all of the attendees here today will be familiar with the challenges of that in terms of website design. I think we're also grappling with that in terms of attention spans, and that being a function not only of technological evolution and devices, but of course, just it seems like everybody's busier nowadays. When I was consulting, I used to do a lot of work in the area of mobile information, how we could ready our scholarly content or repurpose our scholarly content effectively for mobile devices. And I used to talk a lot about interstitial reading, that being the term for sort of reading that happened in between other activities. So, you know, when you're on the bus or, you know, on the train as part of your commute or waiting at an airport or something like that, and how so much more of our reading now seems to happen in that sort of environment, rather than us setting aside structured time to catch up with the professional information that informs what we do. And I think that has real implications, again, for needing to make it easy for people to skim and scan through lots of information and to make quick decisions about what they're going to focus on and make it easy for them to have a phased drill down to the full text. I think there's obviously still value in the research paper, the book chapter. But I think we just can't expect people to be able to go from zero to full text. We have to provide them with a more gradual introduction. And even zero to abstract is too much, I think, in some cases. So I think there is a real value in explaining information more simply and enabling people to make best use of their interstitial reading time to make their way through the literature.
Right, and I think that's an important point, because if publishers think about the investment that they are making in publishing material, and certainly in the open access environment, the investment that the authors themselves are making when it comes to paying APCs, article processing charges, if nobody's clicking, if nobody's getting through to the full text, that investment is evaporating.
Yes, and what's really interesting from our sort of early anecdotal evidence at QDOS is that you can see open access publishers being more engaged, being more active, being more savvy about metrics and services around their publication. And so the thought that goes into making your publication open access extends then to having greater expectations, being prepared to invest more yourself, but also, I think you're right, having higher expectations of the publisher and others in the workflow to help you make sure that your work gets out there.
Right. And Chuck, I think that's an important point, isn't it? Because certainly the research that Rob Johnson and others have undertaken is showing that the open access environment is growing within scholarly publishing. This is a choice that publishers are making to go in that direction. And that really is just the first step in making information available, as we've been discussing. So just going away isn't enough. I think that's an important point.
Absolutely correct. And Charlie mentioned something I think that was critical, was the attention span of the average consumer, the average author these days. So one of the things that we're talking about in depth with publishers is about how to format their experience, how to format that author's experience. They can see clearly and take advantage of these optional services that are good for both the publisher and the author.
Right. And, you know, when we speak about the availability of research, Charlie, obviously we have to think about it in global terms. Open access is something that's been of great concern in the developed world, certainly in the UK, in the US, across Europe. We're seeing now OA mandates coming from China, from Brazil, from elsewhere in Latin America, indeed really on a global basis. And so we have a question here from Andre, because our audience is in fact a global audience and a multilingual one, about how all of this works beyond English. Have you looked at that? And certainly some of the publications, obviously they will be publishing in English, but there will be others. Indeed, one that Clarence is working with, EDP in Paris, they publish in English, but also in French. Does any of that make a difference, or how do we approach that beyond English?
There are so many implications of this, and I think, again, all of today's attendees will be very familiar with them and will be grappling with them too. One of the things that, again, we hope is part of what we can achieve at QDOS is that by simplifying your description of the work and in plain language answering these simple questions, what is this work about, why is it important, you create something that lends itself much more readily both to being understood directly by speakers of other languages who may have some, who may speak some of the same language as you. Because, of course, QDOS isn't just used by English speakers. Some of our explanatory text is in French or is in Spanish or many other languages. So by explaining your work more simply, people who do speak a bit of your language can understand understand it, it also lends itself so much better to auto-translation. And again, we're trying to do some analysis of that in more depth, but our early indications and our crude experiments here show that what you get when you put a QDOS summary into an auto-translation tool, what comes out is much more comprehensible and true to the original meaning than what you get when you try and put an abstract into an auto-translation tool. And this is a challenge across the board, right? I mean, there's complex language in the sciences. There's equally dense and complex language in some of the humanities subjects. So I think everybody benefits if we can start to explain in plain language, and I think that can have huge implications for worldwide accessibility of research in the broadest sense.
Right. Well, these are all issues that we follow very closely at Copyright Clearance Center. This program today is part of an ongoing series of webinars, and we have partnered with the Association of Learned and Professional Society Publishers to create an online open access resource center where you can get information about all of these challenges in the open access publishing environment. That's online at openaccessresources.org. And to the point Charlie Rappel was just making, this is broken down not only by subject areas but by regions as well, because various parts of the world are approaching this in different ways, and it's important to understand the local issues as well as the global issues. So we do hope you will bookmark openaccessresources.org. But with that, I want to thank our guest today, our very special guest, Charlie Rappel, co-founder of QDOS, joining us from Oxford. Thank you, Charlie, for a great program today.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for the opportunity to chat. Always a pleasure.
And Chuck Hemingway, I get to see you every day, but it's always a pleasure having you on the program. Thank you very much.
Very welcome.
And for all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, I want to thank you all for joining us. My name is Chris Keneally. Have a great day.